where they had apparently been caught in flagrante delicto. The man had managed to raise one arm, but a little too late to save his neck. The woman made it all the way to the door before a blow to the upper spine sent a spurt of blood onto the wall beside the doorframe. Routine stuff, the kind of thing that makes up most of my work, and extremely unpleasant. There is just so very much blood in two human beings, and when somebody decides to let it all out at once, it makes a terrible and unattractive mess, which I find deeply offensive. Organizing and analyzing it makes me feel a great deal better, and my job can be deeply satisfying on occasion. But this one was a real mess. I'd found spatter on the ceiling fan, most likely from the machete blade as the killer raised his arm between strokes. And because the fan was on, it flung more spatter to the far corners of the room. It had been a busy day for Dexter. I was just trying to word a paragraph in the report properly to indicate that it had been what we like to call a crime of passion when my phone rang. "Hey, Dex," the voice said, and it sounded so relaxed, even sleepy, that it took me a moment to realize it was Deborah. "Well," I said, "the rumors of your death were exaggerated." She laughed, and again the sound of it was downright mellow, unlike her usual hard-edged chuckle. "Yeah," she said, "I'm alive, but Kyle has kept me pretty busy." "Remind him of the labor laws, sis. Even sergeants need their rest." "I don't know about that," she said. "I feel pretty good without it." And she gave a throaty, two-syllable chuckle that sounded as unlike Deb's as if she had asked me to show her the best way to cut through living human bone. I tried to remember when I had heard Deborah say she felt pretty good and actually sound like she meant it at the same time. I came up blank. "You sound very unlike yourself, Deborah," I said. "What on earth has gotten into you?" This time her laugh was a bit longer, but just as happy. "The usual," she said, and then she laughed again. "Anyway, what's up?" "Oh, not a thing," I said, with innocence blooming from my tongue. "My only sister disappears for days and nights on end without a word, and then turns up sounding like she stepped out of Stepford Sergeant's. So I am naturally curious to know what the hell is going on. That's all." "Well, hell," she said. "I'm touched. It's almost like having a real human brother." "Let's hope it goes no further than almost." "How about we get together for lunch?" she said. "I'm already hungry," I said. "Relampagos?" No, she said. "How about Azul?" I suppose her choice of restaurant made as much sense as everything else about her this morning, because it made no sense at all. Deborah was a blue-collar diner, and Azul was the kind of place where Saudi royalty ate when they were in town. Apparently her transformation into an alien was now complete. "Certainly, Deb. Azul. I'll just sell my car to pay for it and meet you there." 1 o'clock, she said. "And don't worry about the money. Kyle will pick up the tab." She hung up. And I didn't actually say, "Aha!" But a small light flickered on. Kyle would pay, would he? Well, well. And at Azul, too. If the glittery ticky-tack of South Beach is the part of Miami designed for insecure wannabe celebrities, Azul is for people who find the glamour amusing. The little cafes that crowd South Beach compete for attention with a shrill clamor of bright and cheap gaudiness. Azul is so understated by comparison that you wonder if they had ever seen even a single episode of Miami Vice. I left my car with the mandatory valet parking attendant in a small cobblestone circle out front. I am fond of my car, but I will admit that it didn't compare favorably to the line of Ferraris and Rolls-Royces. Even so, the attendant didn't actually decline to park it for me, although he must have guessed that it would not result in the kind of tip he was used to. I suppose my bowling shirt and khaki pants were an unmistakable clue that I didn't have even a single bearer bond or Krugerrand for him. The restaurant itself was dark and cool, and so quiet you could hear an American Express black card drop. The far wall was tinted glass with a door that led out to a terrace. And there was Deborah, sitting at a small corner table outside, looking out over the water. Across from her, facing back toward the door into the restaurant, sat Kyle Chutsky, who would pick up the tab. He was wearing very expensive sunglasses, so perhaps he really would. I approached the table, and a waiter materialized to pull out a chair that was certainly far too heavy for anyone who could afford to eat here. The waiter didn't actually bow, but I could tell that the restraint was an effort. "Hey, buddy," Kyle said as I sat down. He stretched his hand across the table. Since he seemed to believe I was his new best friend, I leaned in and shook hands with him. "How's the spatter trade?" "Always plenty of work," I said. "And how's the mysterious visitor from Washington trade?"
"Never better," he said.
He held my hand in his just a moment too long. I looked down at it. His knuckles were enlarged, as if he had spent too much time sparring with a concrete wall. He slapped his left hand on the table, and I got a glimpse of his pinky ring. It was startlingly effeminate, almost an engagement ring. When he finally let go of my hand, he smiled and swiveled his head toward Deborah. Although with his sunglasses, it was impossible to tell if he was looking at her or just moving his neck around. Deborah smiled back at him. "Dexter was worried about me."
"Hey," Chutsky said, "what are brothers for?"
She glanced at me. "Sometimes I wonder," she said. "Why, Deborah, you know I'm only watching your back," I said. Kyle chuckled.
"Good deal. I got the front," he said,
and they both laughed. She reached across and took his hand. "All the hormones and happiness are setting my teeth on edge," I said. "Tell me, is anybody actually trying to catch that inhuman monster, or are we just going to sit around and make tragic puns?" Kyle swiveled his head back to me and raised an eyebrow. "What's your interest in this, buddy?"
"Dexter has a fondness for inhuman monsters," Deborah said, "like a hobby."
"A hobby?" Kyle said, keeping the sunglasses turned to my face.
I think it was supposed to intimidate me, but for all I knew, his eyes could be closed. Somehow, I managed not to tremble.
"He's kind of an amateur profiler," Deborah said.
Kyle didn't move for a moment, and I wondered if he had gone to sleep behind his dark lenses.
"Huh,"
he finally said, and he leaned back in his chair.
"Well, what do you think about this guy, Dexter?"
"Oh, just the basics so far," I said. "Somebody with a lot of training in the medical area and in covert activities who came unhinged and needs to make a statement. Something to do with Central America. He'll probably do it again, timed for maximum impact, rather than because he feels he has to. So he's not really a standard serial type of... what?" I said. Kyle had lost his laid-back smile and was sitting straight up with his fists clenched.
"What do you mean, Central America?"
I was fairly sure we both knew exactly what I meant by Central America, but I thought saying El Salvador might have been a bit too much. It wouldn't do to lose my casual, "it's just a hobby" credentials, but my whole purpose for coming had been to find out about dokes. And when you see an opening, well, I admit, it had been a little obvious, but it had apparently worked.
"Oh," I said, "isn't that right?
All those years of practice in imitating human expressions paid off for me here, as I put on my best innocently curious face." Kyle apparently couldn't decide if that was right. He worked his jaw muscles and unclenched his fists.
"I should have warned you," Deborah said. "He's good at this."
Chutsky let out a big breath and shook his head. "Yeah," he said. With a visible effort, he leaned back and flicked on his smile again. "Pretty good, buddy. How'd you come up with all that?"
"Oh, I don't know," I said modestly.
"It just seemed obvious. The hard part is figuring out how Sergeant Doakes is involved."
"Jesus H. Christ!" he said, and clenched his fists again.
Deborah looked at me and laughed. Not exactly the same kind of laugh she had given Kyle, but still, it felt good to know she could remember now and then that we were on the same team.
"I told you he's good," she said.
"Jesus Christ!" Kyle said again. He pumped one index finger unconsciously, as if squeezing an invisible trigger, then turned his sunglasses in Deb's direction. "You're right about that," he said, and turned back to me. He watched me hard for a moment, possibly to see if I would bolt for the door or start speaking Arabic, and then he nodded. "What's this about Sergeant Doakes?"
"You're not just trying to drop Doakes in the shit, are you?" Deborah asked me.
"In Captain Matthews' conference room," I said, "when Kyle saw Doakes for the first time, there was a moment when I thought they recognized each other."
"I didn't notice that," Deborah said with a frown.
"You were busy blushing," I said. She blushed again, which I thought was a little redundant. Besides, Doakes was the one who knew who to call when he saw the crime scene. "Doakes knows some stuff," Chutsky admitted, "from his military service."
"What kind of stuff?" I asked.
Chutsky looked at me for a long time, or anyway his sunglasses did. He tapped on the table with that silly pinky ring, and the sunlight flashed off the large diamond in the center. When he finally spoke, it felt like the temperature at our table had dropped 10 degrees. "Buddy," he said, "I don't want to cause you any trouble, but you have to let go of this. Back off. Find a different hobby. Or else you are in a world of shit, and you will get flushed." The waiter materialized at Kyle's elbow before I could think of something wonderful to say to that. Chutsky kept the sunglasses turned toward me for a long moment. Then he handed the menu to the waiter. "The bouillabaisse is really good here," he said. Deborah disappeared for the rest of the week, which did very little for my self-esteem, because no matter how terrible it was for me to admit, without her help, I was stuck. I couldn't come up with any sort of alternative plan for ditching Doakes. He was still there, parked under the tree across from my apartment, following me to Rita's house, and I had no answers. My once proud brain chased its tail and caught nothing but air. I could feel the dark passenger roiling and whimpering and struggling to climb out and take the steering wheel, but there was Doakes looming up through the windshield, forcing me to clamp down and reach for another can of beer. I had worked too hard and too long to achieve my perfect little life, and I wasn't going to ruin it now. The passenger and I could wait a bit longer. Harry had taught me discipline, and that would have to see me through to happier days.
"Patience," Harry said.
He paused to cough into a Kleenex.
"Patient is more important than smart, Dex. You're already smart."
"Thank you," I said, and I meant it politely, really, because I wasn't at all comfortable sitting there in Harry's hospital room. The smell of medicine and disinfectant and urine, mixed with the air of restrained suffering and clinical death, made me wish I was almost anywhere else. Of course, as a callow young monster, I never wondered if Harry might not feel the same.
"In your case, you have to be more patient, because you'll be thinking you're clever enough to get away with it," he said. "You're not. Nobody is."
He paused to cough again, and this time it took longer and seemed to go deeper. To see Harry like this, indestructible,
super cop, foster father Harry, shaking, turning red and weepy-eyed from the strain, was almost too much. I had to look away. When I looked back a moment later, Harry was watching me again.
"I know you, Dexter. Better than you know yourself."
And this was easy to believe, until he followed up with,
"You're basically a good guy."
"No, I'm not," I said, thinking of the wonderful things I had not yet been allowed to do. Even wanting to do them pretty much ruled out any kind of association with goodness. There was also the fact that most of the other pimple-headed, hormone-churning Twinkies my age, who were considered good guys, were no more like me than an orangutan was. But Harry wouldn't hear it.
"Yes, you are," he said. "And you have to believe that you are. Your heart is pretty much in the right place, Dex," he said.
And with that, he collapsed into a truly epic fit of coughing. It lasted for what seemed like several minutes, and then he leaned weakly back onto his pillow. He closed his eyes for a moment, but when he opened them again, they were steely, hairy blue, brighter than ever in the pale green of his dying face.
"Patience," he said,
and he made it sound strong, in spite of the terrible pain and weakness he must have felt.
"You still have a long way to go, and I don't have a whole lot of time, Dexter."
"Yes, I know," I said. He closed his eyes.
"That's just what I mean," he said. "You're supposed to say no. Don't worry, you have plenty of time."
"But you don't," I said, not sure where this was going.
"No, I don't," he said. "But people pretend, to make me feel better about it."
"Would you feel better?"
"No," he said, and opened his eyes again. "But you can't use logic on human behavior. You have to be patient, watch, and learn. Otherwise, you screw up. Get caught and half my legacy."
He closed his eyes again, and I could hear the strain in his voice.
"Your sister will be a good cop. You..."
He smiled slowly, a little sadly.
"You will be something else. Real justice. But only if you're patient. If your chance isn't there, Dexter, wait until it is."
It all seemed so overwhelming to an 18-year-old apprentice monster. All I wanted was to do the thing. Very simple, really. Just go dancing in the moonlight with the bright blade flowing free. Such an easy thing, so natural and sweet, to cut through all the nonsense and right down to the heart of things. But I couldn't. Harry made it complicated. "I don't know what I'll do when you're dead," I said.
"You'll do fine," he said.
"There's so much to remember." Harry reached a hand out and pushed the button that hung on a cord beside his bed.
"You'll remember it," he said.
He dropped the cord, and it was almost as though it pulled the last of the strength from him as it flopped back down by the bedside.
"You'll remember."
He closed his eyes, and for a moment I was all alone in the room. Then the nurse bustled in with a syringe, and Harry opened one eye.
"We can't always do what we think we have to do. So when there's nothing else you can do, you wait," he said,
and held out his arm for his shot.
"No matter what pressure you might feel."
I watched him as he lay there, taking the needle without flinching, and knowing that even the relief it brought was temporary, that his end was coming, and he couldn't stop it. And knowing, too, that he was not afraid, and that he would do this the right way, as he had done everything else in his life the right way.
and I knew this, too. Harry understood me. No one else ever had, and no one else ever would, through all the time and all the world. Only Harry. The only reason I ever thought about being human was to be more like him. Chapter 11. And so, I was patient. It was not an easy thing, but it was the hairy thing. Let the bright, steely spring inside stay coiled and quiet, and wait, watch. Hold the hot, sweet release locked tight in its cold box until it was hairy right to let it skitter out and cartwheel through the night. Sooner or later, some small opening would show, and we could vault through it. Sooner or later, I would find a way to make Doakes blink. I waited. Some of us, of course, find that harder to do than others. And it was several days later, a Saturday morning, that my telephone rang. "God damn it!" said Deborah, without any preamble. It was almost a relief to hear that she was her recognizable, cranky self again. "Fine, thanks. And you?" I said. "Kyle is making me nuts," she said. "He says there's nothing we can do but wait, but he won't tell me what we're waiting for. He disappears for 10 or 12 hours and won't tell me where he was. And then we just wait some more. I am so fucking tired of waiting, my teeth hurt." "Patience is a virtue," I said. "I'm tired of being virtuous, too," she said. "And I am sick to death of Kyle's patronizing smile when I ask him what we can do to find this guy." "Well, Debs, I don't know what I can do except offer my sympathy," I said. "I'm sorry." "I think you can do a whole hell of a lot more than that, bro," she said. I sighed heavily, mostly for her benefit. Sighs register so nicely on the telephone. "This is the trouble with having a reputation as a gunslinger, Debs," I said. "Everybody thinks I can shoot the eye out of a jack at 30 paces, every single time." "I still think it," she said. "Your confidence warms my heart, but I don't understand a thing about this kind of adventure, Deborah. It leaves me completely cold." "I have to find this guy, Dexter, and I want to rub Kyle's nose in it," she said. "I thought you liked him," she snorted. "Jesus, Dexter, you don't know anything about women, do you?" "Of course I like him. That's why I want to rub his nose in it." "Oh, good. Now it makes sense," I said. She paused and then very casually said, "Kyle said some interesting things about Doakes." I felt my long-fanged friend inside stretch just a little and absolutely purr. "You're getting very subtle all of a sudden, Deborah," I said. "All you had to do was ask me." "I just asked, and you gave me all that crap about how you can't help," she said. Suddenly good old plain-speaking Debs again. "So what about it? What have you got?"
"Nothing at the moment," I said.
"Shit," said Deborah.
"But I might be able to find something."
"How soon?"
I admit that I was feeling irked by Kyle's attitude toward me.
"What did he say? I would be in the shit and you will get flushed?" Seriously, who wrote his dialogue?
And Deborah's sudden onset of subtlety, which had been my traditional bailiwick, had done nothing to calm me down. So I shouldn't have said it, but I did. "How about by lunchtime?" I said. "Let's say I'll have something by 1 o'clock.
Baleen, since Kyle can pick up the check." "This I gotta see," she said, and then added, "The stuff about Doakes, it's pretty good." She hung up. "Well, well," I said to myself. Suddenly, I didn't mind the thought of working a little bit on a Saturday.
After all, the only alternative was to hang out at Rita's and watch moss grow on Sergeant Doak's. But if I found something for Debs, I might at long last have the small opening I had hoped for. I merely had to be the clever boy we all believed I was. But where to start? There was precious little to go on, since Kyle had pulled the department away from the crime scene before we had done much more than dust for prints. Many times in the past, I had earned a few modest brownie points with my police colleagues by helping them track down the sick and twisted demons who lived only to kill. But that was because I understood them, since I am a sick and twisted demon myself. This time, I couldn't rely on getting any hints from the dark passenger, who had been lulled into an uneasy sleep. Poor fellow. I had to depend on my own bare-naked native wit, which was also being alarmingly silent at the moment. Perhaps if I gave my brain some fuel, it would kick into high gear. I went to the kitchen and found a banana. It was very nice, but for some reason it didn't launch any mental rockets. I threw the peel in the garbage and looked at the clock. Well, dear boy, that was 5 whole minutes gone by. Excellent. And you have already managed to figure out that you can't figure anything out. Bravo, Dexter. There really were very few places to start. In fact, all I had was the victim and the house. And since I was fairly certain that the victim would not have a lot to say, even if we gave him back his tongue, that left the house. Of course, it was possible that the house belonged to the victim, but the decor had such a temporary look to it, I was sure it didn't. Strange to simply walk away from an entire house like that. But he had done so, and with no one breathing down his neck and forcing a hasty and panicked retreat, which meant that he had done it deliberately, as part of his plan. And that should imply that he had somewhere else to go, presumably still in the Miami area, since Kyle was here looking for him. It was a starting point, and I thought of it all by myself. Welcome home, Mr. Brain. Real estate leaves fairly large footprints, even when you try to cover them up. Within 15 minutes of sitting down at my computer, I had found something. Not actually a whole footprint, but certainly enough to make out the shape of a couple of toes. The house on Northwest 4th Street was registered to Ramon Puntilla. How he expected to get away with that in Miami, I don't know. But Ramon Puntilla was a Cuban joke name, like Joe Blow in English. But the house was paid for, and no taxes were due. A sound arrangement for someone who valued privacy as much as I assumed our new friend did. The house had been bought with a single cash payment, a wire transfer from a bank in Guatemala. This seemed a bit odd, with our trail starting in El Salvador and leading through the murky depths of a mysterious government agency in Washington. Why take a left turn into Guatemala? But a quick online study of contemporary money laundering showed that it fit very well. Apparently, Switzerland and the Cayman Islands were no longer a la mode, and if one wished for discreet banking in the Spanish-speaking world, Guatemala was all the rage. This raised the interesting question of how much money Dr. Dismember had, and where it came from. But it was a question that led nowhere at the moment. I had to assume that he had enough for another house when he was done with the first one, and probably in the same approximate price range. All right, then. I went back to my Dade County real estate database and looked for other properties recently purchased the same way, from the same bank. There were 7. 4 of them had sold for more than $1 million, which struck me as a bit high for disposable property. They had probably been bought by nothing more sinister than run-of-the-mill drug lords and Fortune 500 CEOs on the run. That left 3 properties that seemed possible. One of them was in Liberty City, a predominantly black inner-city area of Miami. But on closer inspection,
It turned out to be a block of apartments.
Of the two remaining properties, one was in Homestead, within sight of the gigantic dump heap of city garbage known locally as Mount Trashmore. The other was also in the south end of town, just off Quail Roost Drive. Two houses. I was willing to bet that someone new had just moved into one of them and was doing things that might startle the ladies from the welcome wagon. No guarantees, of course, but it certainly seemed likely. And it was, after all, just in time for lunch. Baleen was a very pricey place that I wouldn't have attempted on my own modest means. It was the kind of oak-paneled elegance that makes you feel the need for a cravat and spats. It also has one of the best views of Biscayne Bay in the city, and if one is lucky, there are a handful of tables that take advantage of this. Either Kyle was lucky, or his mojo had bowled over the head waiter, because he and Deborah were waiting outside at one of these tables, working on a bottle of mineral water and a plate of what appeared to be crab cakes. I grabbed one and took a bite as I slid into a chair facing Kyle. "Yummy," I said. "This must be where good crabs go when they die."
"Debbie says you have something for us," Kyle said.
I looked at my sister, who had always been Deborah, or Debs, but certainly never Debbie. She said nothing, however, and appeared willing to let this egregious liberty go by. So I turned my attention back to Kyle. He was wearing the designer sunglasses again, and his ridiculous pinky ring sparkled as he brushed the hair carelessly back from his forehead.
"I hope I have something," I said.
"But I do want to be careful not to get flushed." Kyle looked at me for a long moment, then he shook his head, and a reluctant smile moved his mouth perhaps a quarter of an inch upward.
"All right," he said, "busted. But you'd be surprised how often that kind of line really works."
"I'm sure I'd be flabbergasted," I said. I passed him the printout from my computer. "While I catch my breath, you might want to look at this." Kyle frowned and unfolded the paper.
"What's this?"
Deborah leaned forward, looking like the eager young police hound she was. "You found something. I knew you would," she said.
"It's just two addresses," said Kyle.
"One of them may very well be the hiding place of a certain unorthodox medical practitioner with a Central American past," I said, and I told him how I found the addresses. To his credit, he looked impressed, even with the sunglasses on.
"I should have thought of this," he said. "That's very good." He nodded and flicked the paper with a finger. "Follow the money. Works any time."
"Of course I can't be positive," I said.
"Well, I'd bet on it," he said. "I think you found Dr. Danco."
I looked at Deborah. She shook her head, so I looked back at Kyle's sunglasses. "Interesting name. Is it Polish?"
Chutsky cleared his throat and looked out over the water. "Before your time, I guess. There was a commercial back then. Danco presents the auto veggie. It slices, it dices."
He swiveled his dark lenses back to me.
"That's what we called him. Dr. Danco. He made chopped up vegetables. It's the kind of joke you like when you're far from home and seeing terrible things," he said.
"But now we're seeing them close to home," I said. "Why is he here?"
"Long story," Kyle said.
"That means he doesn't want to tell you," Deborah said. "In that case, I'll have another crab cake," I said. I leaned over and took the last one off the plate. They really were quite good. "Come on, Chutsky," Deborah said. "There's a good chance we know where this guy is. Now what are you going to do about it?"
He put a hand on top of hers and smiled. "I'm going to have lunch," he said, and he picked up a menu with his other hand.
Deborah looked at his profile for a minute. Then she pulled her hand away. "Shit,"
she said.
The food actually was excellent, and Chutsky tried very hard to be chummy and pleasant, as if he had decided that when you can't tell the truth, you might as well be charming. In fairness, I couldn't complain, since I generally get away with the same trick, but Deborah didn't seem very happy. She sulked and poked at her food while Kyle told jokes and asked me if I liked the Dolphins' chances to go all the way this year. I didn't really care if the Dolphins won the Nobel Prize for Literature, but as a well-designed artificial human, I had several authentic-sounding prepared remarks on the subject, which seemed to satisfy Chutsky, and he chattered on in the chummiest way possible. We even had dessert, which seemed to me to be pushing the distract-them-with-food ploy a little far, particularly since neither Deborah nor I was at all distracted. But it was quite good food, so it would have been barbaric of me to complain. Of course, Deborah had worked very hard her whole life to become barbaric, so when the waiter placed an enormous chocolate thing in front of Chutsky, who turned to Debs with two forks and said, "Well?" She took the opportunity to fling a spoon into the center of the table. "No," she said to him, "I don't want another fucking cup of coffee, and I don't want a fucking chocolate foo-foo. I want a fucking answer. When are we going to get this guy?" He looked at her with mild surprise, and even a certain fondness, as though people in his line of work found spoon-throwing women quite useful and charming. But he thought her timing might be slightly off. "Can I finish my dessert first?" he said.
This ends Disc 3. Dearly Devoted Dexter, Disc 4.
Chapter 12. Deborah drove us south on Dixie Highway. Yes, I did say us. To my surprise, I had become a valuable member of the Justice League and was informed that I was being honored with the opportunity to put my irreplaceable self in harm's way. Although I was far from delighted, one small incident almost made it worthwhile. As we stood outside the restaurant, waiting for the valet to bring Deborah's car, Chutsky had quietly muttered, "What the fuck?" and sauntered away down the driveway. I watched him as he walked out to the gate and gestured at a maroon Taurus that had casually parked there beside a palm tree. Debs glared at me as if it was all my fault, and we both watched Chutsky wave at the driver's window, which rolled down to reveal, of course, the ever-watchful Sergeant Doakes. Chutsky leaned on the gate and said something to Doakes, who glanced up the drive to me, shook his head, and then rolled up the window and drove away. Chutsky didn't say anything when he rejoined us, but he did look at me a little differently before he climbed into the front seat of the car. It was a 20-minute drive south to where Quail Roost Drive runs east and west and crosses Dixie Highway, right beside a mall. Just two blocks in, a series of side streets leads into a quiet, working-class neighborhood made up of small, mostly neat houses, usually with two cars in the short driveway and several bicycles scattered across the lawn. One of these streets bent to the left and led to a cul-de-sac, and it was here, at the end of the street, that we found the house, a pale yellow stucco dwelling with an overgrown yard. There was a battered gray van in the driveway with dark red lettering that said, "Hermanos Cruz Limpiadores," Cruz Brothers Cleaners. Debs drove around the cul-de-sac and up the street about half a block to a house with half a dozen cars parked out front and on the lawn, and loud rap music coming from inside. Debs turned our car around to face our target and parked under a tree. "What do you think?" she said. Chutsky just shrugged.
"Uh-huh. Could be," he said. "Let's watch a while."
And that was the entire extent of our sparkling conversation for a good half hour. hardly enough to keep the mind alive, and I found myself mentally drifting off to the small shelf in my apartment, where a little rosewood box holds a number of glass slides, the kind you place under a microscope. Each slide contained a single drop of blood, very well dried blood, of course. I wouldn't have the nasty stuff in my home otherwise. 40 tiny windows into my shadow other self. One drop from each of my small adventures. There had been first nurse, so long ago, who had killed her patients by careful overdose, under the guise of easing pain. And the very next slot in the box, the high school shop teacher, who strangled nurses. Wonderful contrast, and I do love irony. So many memories, and as I stroked each one, it made me even more eager to make a new one, number 41, even though number 40, McGregor, was hardly dry. But because it was connected to my next project, and therefore felt incomplete, I was anxious to get on with it. As soon as I could be sure about Riker, and then find some way, I sat up. Perhaps the rich dessert had clogged my cranial arteries, but I had temporarily forgotten Deborah's bribe. "Deborah?" I said. She glanced back at me with a small frown of concentration on her face. "What?" "Here we are," I said. "No shit." "None whatsoever. A complete lack of shit, in fact. And all thanks to my mighty mental labors. Wasn't there some mention of a few things you were going to tell me?" She glanced at Chutsky. He was staring straight ahead, still wearing the sunglasses, which didn't blink. "Yeah, all right," she said. "In the army, Doakes was in Special Forces." "I know that. It's in his personnel file." "What you don't know, buddy," said Kyle without moving, "is that there's a dark side to Special Forces. Doakes was with them." A very tiny smile creased his face for just a second. So small and sudden, I might have imagined it. "Once you go over to the dark side, it's forever. You can't go back." I watched Chutsky sit completely motionless for a moment longer, and then I looked at Debs. She shrugged. "Doakes was a shooter," she said. "The army let the guys in El Salvador borrow him, and he killed people for them." "Have gun, will travel," Chutsky said. "That explains his personality," I said, thinking it also explained a great deal more, like the echo I heard coming from his direction when my dark passenger called out. "You have to understand how it was," Chutsky said. It was a little eerie to hear his voice coming from a completely unmoving and unemotional face, as if the voice was really coming from a tape recorder somebody had put in his body. "We believed we were saving the world, giving up our lives and any hope for something normal and decent for the cause. Turns out, we were just selling our souls. Me, Doakes, and Dr. Danko," I said. "And Dr. Danko." Chutsky sighed and finally moved, turning his head briefly to Deborah, then looking forward again. He shook his head, and the movement seemed so large and theatrical after his stillness that I felt like applauding. "Dr. Danko started out as an idealist, just like the rest of us. He found out in med school there was something missing inside him, and he could do things to people and not feel any empathy at all. Nothing at all. It's a lot rarer than you think." "Oh, I'm sure it is," I said, and Debs glared at me. "Danko loved his country," Chutsky went on. "So he switched to the dark side too, on purpose, to use this talent. And in El Salvador, it blossomed. He would take somebody that we brought him and just..." He paused and took a breath, blew it out slowly. "Shit. You saw what he does. Very original, I said. Creative. Chutsky gave a small snort of laughter that had no humor in it.
Creative, yeah, you could say that.
Chutsky swung his head slowly left, right, left.
I said it didn't bother him to do that stuff. In El Salvador, he got to like it. He'd sit in on the interrogation and ask personal questions. Then, when he started to... he'd call the person by name, like he was a dentist or something, and say, "Let's try number 5, or number 7, whatever." Like there were all these different patterns.
"What kind of patterns?" I asked.
It seemed like a perfectly natural question, showing polite interest and keeping the conversation moving. But Chutsky swiveled around in his seat and looked at me as if I was something that might require a whole bottle of floor cleaner.
"This is funny to you," he said.
"Not yet," I said. He stared at me for what seemed like an awfully long time. Then he just shook his head and faced front again.
"I don't know what kind of pattern, buddy. Never asked. Sorry. Probably something to do with what he cut off first. Just something to keep himself amused. And he'd talk to them, call them by name, show them what he was doing."
Chutsky shuddered.
Somehow that made it worse. You should have seen what it did to the other side.
"How about what it did to you?" Deborah demanded.
He let his chin fall forward to his chest, then straightened again. "That too," he said. "Anyway, something finally changed at home. The politics, back in the Pentagon. New regime and all that. And they didn't want anything to do with what we had been doing down there. So very quietly, the word came that Dr. Danko might buy us a small piece of political accommodation with the other side if we delivered him."
"You gave up your own guy to be killed?" I asked.
It hardly seemed fair. I mean, I may be untroubled by a sense of morals, but at least I play by the rules.
Kyle was silent for a long moment.
"I told you we sold our souls, buddy," he said at last.
He smiled again, a little longer this time.
"Yeah, we set him up, and they took him down."
"But he's not dead," Deborah said, always practical.
"We got scammed," Chutsky said. "The Cubans took him."
"What Cubans?" Deborah asked. "You said El Salvador."
"Back in the day, any time there was trouble in the Americas, there were Cubans. They were propping up one side, just like we did with the other. And they wanted our doctor. I told you, he was special. So they took him, tried to turn him, put him in the Isle of Pines."
"Is that a resort?" I asked.
Chutsky gave a single small snort of a laugh. "The last resort, maybe. Isle of Pines is one of the hardest prisons in the world. Dr. Danko spent some real quality time there. They let him know his own side had given him up, and they really put him through it. And a few years later, one of our guys gets caught and turns up like that. No arms or legs, the whole deal. Danko is working for them. And now..." He shrugged. "Either they turned him loose, or he skipped. Doesn't matter which. He knows who set him up, and he's got a list."
"Is your name on that list?" Deborah demanded.
"Maybe," Chutsky said.
"Is Doakes's?" I asked. "After all, I can be practical, too."
"Maybe," he said again, which didn't seem very helpful.
All the stuff about Danko was interesting, of course, but I was here for a reason.
"Anyway," Chutsky said, "that's what we're up against." Nobody seemed to have much to say to that, including me. I was turning the things I'd heard from side to side,
looking for some way to make it help me with my Doakes infestation. I will admit that I saw nothing at the moment, which was humbling. But I did seem to have a slightly better understanding of dear Dr. Danko. So he was empty inside too, was he? A raptor in sheep's clothing. And he too had found a way to use his talent for the greater good. Again, just like dear old Dexter. But now he had come off the rails, and he began to seem a little bit more like just another predator, no matter the unsettling direction his technique took him. And oddly enough, with that insight, another thought nosed its way back into the bubbling cauldron of Dexter's dark underbrain. It had been a passing fancy before. Now it began to seem like a very good idea. Why not find Dr. Danko myself and do a little dark dance with him? He was a predator gone bad, just like all the others on my list. No one, not even Doakes, could possibly object to his demise. If I had wondered casually about finding the doctor before, now it began to take on an urgency that drove away my frustration with missing out on Riker. So he was like me, was he? We would see about that. A jolt of something cold bristled up my spine, and I found that I truly looked forward to meeting the doctor and discussing his work in depth. In the distance, I heard the first rumble of thunder as the afternoon storm moved in. Shit, said Chutsky. Is it going to rain? Every day at this time, I said. That's no good, he said. We got to do something before it rains. You're up, Dexter. Me? I said, startled out of my meditations on Maverick medical malpractice. I had adjusted to going along for the ride, but to actually have to do something was a little more than I had bargained for. I mean, here we had two hardened warriors sitting idly by while we sent delicate dimpled Dexter into danger? Where's the sense in that?
You, Chutsky said. I need to hang back and see what happens. If it's him, I can take him out better. And Debbie?
He smiled at her, even though she seemed to be scowling at him.
Debbie is too much of a cop. She walks like a cop, she stares like a cop, and she might try to write him a ticket. He'd make her from a mile away. So it's you, Dex.
It's me doing what? I asked, and I admit that I was still feeling some righteous indignation.
Just walk by the house one time, around the cul-de-sac and back. Keep your eyes and ears open, but don't be too obvious.
I don't know how to be obvious, I said.
Great, then this should be a piece of cake.
It was clear that neither logic nor completely justified irritation was going to do any good, so I opened the door and got out. But I couldn't resist a parting shot. I leaned in Deborah's window and said, I hope I live to regret this. And very obligingly, the thunder rumbled again nearby. I strolled down the sidewalk toward the house. There were leaves underfoot, a couple of crushed juice cartons from some kid's lunchbox. A cat rushed out onto a lawn as I passed and sat down very suddenly to lick its paws and stare at me from a safe distance. At the house with all the cars in front, the music changed, and someone yelled, "Whoo!" It was nice to know that somebody was having a good time while I strolled into mortal danger. I turned left and began to walk the curve around the cul-de-sac. I glanced at the house with the van in front, feeling very proud of the completely non-obvious way I pulled it off. The lawn was shaggy, and there were several soggy newspapers in the driveway. There didn't seem to be any visible pile of discarded body parts, and no one rushed out and tried to kill me. But as I passed, I could hear a TV blaring a game show in Spanish. A male voice rose above the hysterical announcers, and a dish clattered. and as a puff of wind brought the first large and hard raindrops, it also carried the smell of ammonia from the house. I continued on past the house and back to the car. A few more drops of rain pelted down, and a rumble of thunder rolled by, but the downpour held off. I climbed back into the car. "Nothing terribly sinister," I reported. "The lawn needs mowing, and there's a smell of ammonia. Voices in the house. Either he talks to himself, or there's more than one of him." "Ammonia," Kyle said. "Yes, I think so," I said. "Probably just cleaning supplies." Kyle shook his head. "Cleaning services don't use ammonia. The smell's too strong. But I know who does."
"Who?"
Deborah demanded. He grinned back at her. "I'll be right back," he said, and got out of the car.
"Kyle!"
Deborah said, but he just waved a hand and walked right up to the front door of the house.
"Shit,"
Deborah muttered, as he knocked and stood, glancing up at the dark clouds of the approaching storm. The front door opened. A short and stocky man with a dark complexion and black hair falling over his forehead stared out. Chutsky said something to him, and for a moment neither of them moved. The small man looked up the street, then at Kyle. Kyle slowly pulled a hand from his pocket and showed the dark man something. Money? The man looked at whatever it was, looked at Chutsky again, and then held the door open. Chutsky went in. The door slammed shut.
"Shit,"
Deborah said again. She chewed on a fingernail, a habit I hadn't seen from her since she was a teenager.